Welcome to Better Health Guy Blogcasts, empowering your better health. And now, here's Scott, your Better Health Guy. The content of this show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose, treat, or cure any illness or medical condition. Nothing in today's discussion is meant to serve as medical advice or as information to facilitate self-treatment. As always, please discuss any potential health-related decisions with your own personal medical authority.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode number 93 of the Better Health Guy blogcast series. Today's guest is Dr. Armin Schwarzbach, and the topic of the show is Armin Labs. Dr. Armin Schwarzbach is a medical doctor and a specialist in laboratory medicine from the laboratory Armin Labs in Augsburg, Germany. He began by studying biochemistry at Hoechst AG in Frankfurt, Germany, and pharmacy at the University of Mainz in Germany in 1984. In 1985, he studied medicine for 6 years at the University of Mainz and finished his MD in 1991. Dr. Schwarzbach developed the worldwide first radioimmunoassay for human gastric inhibitory polypeptide from 1986 to 1991, getting his PhD in 1992. He is a member of the Swiss Association for Tick-Borne Diseases, the German Association of Clinical Chemistry and Laboratory Medicine, and the German Society for Medical Laboratory Specialists. He is an advisory board member of AONM London, England, and board member of German Borreliosis Society, and member and former board member of the International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, or ILADS, and has served as an expert on advisory committees on Lyme disease in England, Australia, Canada, Ireland, France, and Germany. Dr. Schwarzbach is the founder and CEO of Armin Labs in Augsburg, Germany, and has specialized in diagnostic tests and treatment options for patients with tick-borne diseases for over 20 years. And now my interview with Dr. Armin Schwarzbach. I have had the opportunity to get to know Dr. Armin Schwarzbach at various conferences over the years, and I'm personally very excited about many of the options available through Armin Labs in Germany. It's an honor to have Dr. Schwarzbach on the show today. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Scott, for the invitation to the day tonight in Germany. And it's a great pleasure to me to speak with you.
Thank you. You have worked in broad areas of medicine in your career. What drew you to the realm of Lyme disease? Did you have some personal experience with your own health that drew you into the Lyme arena? Or was there something else that led you to making Lyme disease a focus of the work that you do today?
It's a longer story, also in my case. I'm not sick. Family members are not sick. But I started with a laboratory to test ticks in 2000. We were the first, it's now 18 years ago. We started a campaign by a bigger laboratory group in Germany, and we offered tick testing, which was a brand new field for me. I said, wow, tick testing, what's that? Do we need to test the ticks? Because I've learned chronic Lyme doesn't exist. So that was where I came from a hospital time in the 90s. Lyme disease, it was the time of H. pylori. We can talk a little about that later. But I didn't know about Lyme disease that time, but we tested the ticks. It was marketing, some money. And we had also in Germany the vaccination campaign together with our tick testing campaign from the SYNLAB. It was the group. I can name it here, I think so. We did this, and okay, then I thought myself, okay, that's fine to check the ticks, the tiny spider-like animals or whatever, but chronic Lyme doesn't exist. But in 2005, I came more and more into this field, and I did a lot of presentation about tick testing and a little about Lyme symptoms. And then a patient came to me, and she said, oh, Armin, I have multiple sclerosis. I said, yes, multiple sclerosis, but what you talked to me, my symptoms, can it be Lyme? I said, multiple sclerosis is not Lyme disease, you know, it's different. And then the next step was I offered her a new test that time. It was named the LTT, a lymphocyte transformation test. Now we name it ELISpot test. And I tested her by SYNLAB. I was very critical with this because I learned if the ELISA is negative in laboratory, exclusion of Lyme disease, and her ELISA was negative. But this LTT was positive, or today we would say the ELISA spot was positive. Then the doctor called me, the house doctor, the GP. Could this patient suffer from Lyme disease? I said, maybe. The patient was blind. The patient was suffering 5 years sitting in a wheelchair. She got corticosteroids. She got worse, worse. She was 40 years old. It was a tragedy for her. And then I said, oh, yes, doctor, maybe it could be Lyme disease. I'm not sure myself, 2005. And after that, the doctor decided to do a trial with Rocephin. It's an antibiotic or cephalosporin of third generation. And the patient, believe me, recovered completely from this multiple sclerosis diagnosis, which was wrong in my opinion. How was she diagnosed? By the ELISA spot. The spinal fluid was negative. Corticosteroids were wrongful. So this time was a change in my career, in my chapters, to say chronic Lyme exists. It can mimic multiple sclerosis. And I would name her diagnosis today. She suffered from chronic neuroborreliosis with multiple sclerosis-like symptoms. That was completely a change in my point of view. And then I did studies on the Western blots and ELISA, how sufficient they are. And I was really shocked about it. I compared that with different test pit users, and I found that Western blots just 40% positive. How can that be? They are not standardized. We got different results from different laboratories, from different test pit users. ELISA, forget about the ELISA. This is a little my starting point.
So tell us then a little bit about the ELISpot. How is it different from a Western blot, a PCR test, or other tests that people commonly explore for Lyme and co-infections? What immune cells is it looking at? What is the difference between T and B cells? Just give us a little bit of a background on the ELISpot.
Yeah, the ELISpot became famous by tuberculosis. That happens in the 2000s also, in parallel, I would say 2000-2005, because in tuberculosis, we didn't find antibodies in infected tuberculosis patients. And there's another test, the Tyne test or prick test with needles, which failed also. So there was development to develop ELISpots. ELISpot belongs to IgIR, which means interferon gamma release assays. It's a cytokine release assay. And this was much more sensitive for tuberculosis than the conventional antibodies. So also CDC left the way completely for tuberculosis antibodies, and they put in the guidelines the ELISpot interferon gamma release assays for tuberculosis, but not for Lyme disease. It seems to be an acceptance problem of Lyme. In this case, I came to the Borrelia ELISpot by this patient, the LTT it was named that time, and I was focused on the T cells, the Th1 testings. Normally, doctors like me, I was educated 6 years in laboratory medicine, infectious diseases. I worked in hospital with infected patients. I worked with HIV patients. I worked with Salmonella, Yersinia. I worked with malaria patients. I worked with hepatitis patients. I worked with a lot of these patients. But also in the 90s, chronic Lyme in my hospital doesn't exist or didn't exist. We tested patients the first time for H. pylori that time. I remember 1991, which is a bacterium. We were surprised that this bacterium survived the acid milieu in the stomach, and we treated these patients successfully in stomach aches or let me name it also some ulcers or some also cancer. We treated the patient with antibiotics successfully. And by this history, I thought more about the Th1, the ELISpot testings. Could that be an alternative? And meanwhile, I really think that the ELISpot complements the antibody testings. I would not discuss away the antibody testings because all of our specialists in Germany, laboratory specialists, are educated in antibodies. But we don't test T cells. We always check the antibodies. IgG, IgM, this is conventional testing.
So the antibody testing is looking at B cells and the ELISpot testing is looking at T cells, correct?
This is an easy way to explain it, yes.
Okay.
In the beginning, when you have a contact with a pathogen, whatever, if it's tuberculosis or it's a virus or Borrelia in this case, there's a very ancient, very old cell recognizing this in a macrophage, it's named, and then by this there's a two-way system into the TH1, TH2 system from a very old TH0 cell. And this is a differentiation in all of our immune systems, also your immune system. And interestingly, before you develop antibodies, you always develop TH1 T cell immune reactions. So in bulls or rashes, in day 1, 2, 3, you develop positive ELISpots, no antibodies. So it's also very helpful, we come later to that, in diagnosing also bulls or rashes if you're not sure for that.
Is there a connection with the ELISpot technology and the work that Vera Steschkol originally did with the MELISA testing for heavy metals? Is it similar in what it's looking for?
Yes, exactly. It belongs to the same group, the IGRA group. And these are some subspecies of testing. The main expression is interferon gamma release assay, but one subspecies is the ELISpot and the other is the MELISA testing. So the MELISA technique is not available for Borrelia and not available for other pathogens, but it's very established in the environmental medicine world to diagnose allergy intolerance or intoxications.
Beautiful. What are some of the organisms that your lab offers ELISpot testing for?
Yeah, that was also a challenge for me because I'm on the way to say just Lyme doesn't exist. You know, all of the patients I diagnosed have multiple infections. It's the same model Horowitz is doing in the same direction. So what we are testing and what we can offer is for Borrelia burgdorferi, the ELISpot, for Miyamotoi, which is very important, for Anaplasma ehrlichia, we can do ELISpot, for Bartonella, for Babesia, for Chlamydia, for Mycoplasma yersinia, for all viruses, which are very important, Epstein-Barr virus, herpes simplex virus, cytomegalovirus, varicella zoster virus. Also now we have development for yeast and mold ELISpots. We can check for Candida, Aspergillus. Just to say one sentence, the ELISpot or MELISA techniques are 20 to 200-fold more sensitive than antibody testing. To know that rule in laboratory, it's a general rule that it's a very high sensitivity.
What is the process that you go through in the laboratory from the time that a blood sample comes into the lab? What's the process involved in how an ELISpot is actually performed?
Yes, that was the next challenge. Absolutely good question. ELISpot is a time-critical method. Antibody testing is a protein testing. It's not so time-critical. So you can keep a serum for antibody testing 2 weeks, and there's no challenge in fast delivery. The ELISpot needs really a vitality of the lymphocytes for the interferon gamma release. So this time critical is 3 to 4 days. And by some special tubes I've developed with a test producer, I'm very engaged in pre-analytics. So this is the phase before the analytical process. And believe me, 60% of the quality is the pre-analytics, which tubes you select, what is the logistics, how long is transportation time, if you shake a sample, if you make hemolysis or whatever, if you put some pressure on the veins, all of these factors can influence a good result. So for me, the pre-analytics is so important. And then I developed test kits that was coming out 2005 by this patient because I was overrun by hundreds in Germany. They all said, I have multiple sclerosis. I mean, maybe I have Lyme disease. Can you check me? And for me, the challenge, how to get the blood in the highest quality in my laboratory. Therefore, I have developed a special test kit that time. That works internationally. So you can send it from Singapore, from New Zealand, from Alaska, everywhere. And then you need a good logistics behind. If logistics is not good, it will fail. And you need a good customs system, you know, because import, export of some samples might be difficult.
So then once you receive the blood, what's the process that you go through in the lab to determine whether or not someone has a positive ELISpot?
Yes, we isolate the lymphocytes from the special tubes. And in these lymphocytes, we check with a positive control if they are still active or not. So there can be some restrictions in that. Also, maybe two less lymphocytes. If you, for example, use high corticosteroids in the vein or azathioprine, which is a strong immune suppressor, or some chemotherapies, but we check everything so that the quality is very high. The process is to isolate the lymphocytes by ultracentrifugation, and then we put it in a 96 well. And in each well is an antigen of Borrelia or Chlamydia. We test also to mention for all three different subspecies, Garinii, Sensus stricta, which is very common in USA, Canada, and we check also for Aphthelia, which makes some skin problems. And the process goes on 2 days, we need for testings. And in the end, it's an ELISA technique, but don't mix it up with Borrelia ELISA. ELISPOT, ELI stands for ELISA technique at the end. But it's a spot technique, and you see a black spot where a living lymphocyte reacts against the antigen you put in onto the well, and then you see it if it's active or not.
So essentially the infections or the microbes are in each of the different wells, or then introducing essentially a component of the immune system into the well to see what type of reaction that person's immune cells have to a given antigen, right, which then indicates whether or not their immune system has seen that particular microbe recently.
Yes. Okay. You can just detect what you put into the well. That's the first condition. And the reaction then is a high specific one. You know, if you put Yersinia, for example, Yersinia antigen, this is 99.9% purified. If you put tuberculosis into the well, it's also purified antigen. So it's not unspecific reaction. That's completely nonsense.
So you mentioned that the Borrelia testing will identify Aphthelii and Garinii. What about for some of the co-infections? How specific, let's say, are the Bartonella and Babesia ELISpots? If someone has Bartonella quintana rather than Bartonella hensilei, or Babesia divergens or Duncani rather than Microti, will it detect those or not?
No, it will not detect. We have the antigen from hensilei, which is the cat's scratch wound, I think number one in the world from but the subspecies. It depends on the antigen. Okay, you can say it cross-reacts within the Bartonella species group, but on the other hand, it's a high specific subspecies for hensilei. So I would say we cannot detect all subspecies. On the other hand, we have the main subspecies. In it also, we have different other Borrelia subspecies.
Is it possible to do an ELISpot more at the genus level if you wanted to do that? Could you combine multiple different types of Bartonellas and then do it at a higher level, potentially?
Yes, that could be a good idea. I'm not the test producer, so the testing is not in-house testing. It's not home code. It's a CE mark. It's an IVD register testing, like you do hematology. Because my aim is to bring the highest quality and not some home food results to the patients,
which are not specific. Beautiful.
So you can trust 100%.
My observation over the years has been that getting a positive test result for Bartonella and Babesia is particularly challenging, that people often clinically present with symptoms that appear to be those co-infections but cannot get a positive test. So is your observation that the ELISpot seems to close the gap and give us more indications when these co-infections are present?
Yes, exactly. That's the point. We have higher sensitivity, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. 200 fold, and I see a lot of patients with no antibodies,
but
positive ELISpots.
We know that false negative test results in Lyme disease are fairly common, particularly when the immune system is suppressed and we're looking for antibodies. So if the immune system is suppressed, is that potentially a reason that the ELISpot may not yield a positive result? And then kind of extending on that, do we consider the ELISpot an antibody test or an immune test? Or since we're looking for the response outside the body, are we considering it more of an antigen test?
It's also a very good question. We run a positive control for the vitality, for the general interferon gamma release reaction. And what I see in many patients, that we find some reduced general T cellular immune deficiencies. So the question is why? And we come now more and more to the model that we have a lot of opportunistic infections in this patient with chronic Lyme or chronic co-infections or together. And these are especially viruses. I find so many positive results for the herpes virus group, which includes EBV or herpes simplex virus 1-2 or cytomegalovirus or varicella or HHV-6/7/8, whatever. So we find more and more immune suppressions by this opportunistic infections, virus infection coming up, and they suppress the general T cell controls.
So is that control measurement reported in the results, or is there a certain threshold at which you say we unfortunately cannot get an ELISpot result with a high level of confidence because of this person's immune status?
No, we have a reporting system. We are forced to do that because we are accredited laboratory according to the international DIN standards. So we need to report this if there's a restriction of the positive control. And I write also which viruses we find in this patient.
So if there is, if the positive control shows that the immune system is suppressed, and that potentially means that the other ELISpot testing may not show as positive of a result, that's something that the ordering practitioner can see from the results to say, well, these may actually be lower because the control was also low. Is that true?
Exactly. Okay.
And would you say that this is more, the ELISpot, is it more in the realm of antibody tests or antigen tests based on how it works?
The ELISpot is an indirect test, like the antibody test.
Okay.
It's not a direct PCR method, but we have difficulties to find Borrelia in the blood.
And does a positive ELISpot necessarily represent a disease state, or can someone have high positive responses on the ELISpot but not be an indication of a disease state because their immune system is healthy and essentially they could still be asymptomatic?
Yes, absolutely. We see these cases. On the other hand, Scott, I would say never test a healthy patient. It doesn't make really sense because whatever laboratory test you're doing, you always come into a problem how to explain it now. And in this patient, I would say some control this. There has some have persistent forms, and we control a lot of pathogens, not just Borrelia or other infections, but you don't get symptomatic. On the other hand, we find immune reactions. My opinion is about that. The higher the ELISpot, the better is the patient, the lower the worse. And then you come to the restrictions of the T cell control, which is negative. So then the virus are growing up. It's similar to HIV model. We have the same experiences.
So what you're suggesting, if the ELISpot result is really high, that person still has some immune competence. If it's low,
yes, absolutely.
If it's
absolutely
low, but if it's lower but still detectable, there is a presence and activity of a microbe, but the immune system is not necessarily responding in a competent manner.
You have the same with the antibodies. You know, if you treat patients with negative antibodies and they have Herxheimer-like reactions, then they blow up with the antibodies again because the Borrelia is suppressing and other pathogens too, co-infections, the T-cellular immune system and the B-cellular immune system.
Beautiful. Have you been able to gain any insight around which microbes are the most persistent based on repeat ELISpot testing? So are some infections easier to manage or clear compared to others that might be more persistent?
Mm-hmm. Borrelia is a challenge in the world, absolutely, because of climate change and more and more ticks everywhere. But we see big issues with Chlamydia pneumonia and Mycoplasma pneumonia. This is an aerogen-transmitted pathogen by droplet infections. It's very common, and it's immune-controlled. It makes persister, cystic forms, biofilms, whatever you want. But this pathogen is, the transmission is higher within humans and also in the dogs, domestics. And so we discussed now transmission from dogs to humans, humans to dogs by a cough. It's easily to transmit that. And the symptoms of a chlamydia infection or mycoplasma are similar to Lyme disease. So you don't know, is it now Lyme disease? Is it chlamydia or is it both? And what I see, 80% of Lyme patients have chlamydia infections.
So Bartonella and Babesia, not particularly persistent based on what you've seen with repeat testing. They can be treated fairly effectively, and you do see then reductions in the ELISpot such that there's no ongoing activity. Beautiful.
Yes, this is an important point also to say, how long is ELISpot positive? What do you think? The ELISpot has a depends on the lymphocyte, and the half-life time of a lymphocyte is 3 to 4 weeks. So you can say within 6 to 8 weeks, the ileus spot after successful treatments should normalize. But it doesn't make sense to test ileus spots. It's good for laboratories, but it doesn't bring you forward. So if you have a patient treated successfully, patient is symptom-free or much better, then a retest makes sense 6 to 8 weeks or 1 month, I say, in general. You know, not too early, because it costs money, the test. And after that, the ileus spot should be negative, because the half-life time of a lymphocyte reacting against the antigen somewhere in the body is 3 to 4 weeks. So that means 6 to 8 weeks maximum, then they die themselves.
So that was actually my next question. People often ask how they can measure success of treatment. I've seen some practitioners that maybe will do repeat Western blot testing. I've never been clear that that tells us a whole lot, because I don't think these pathogens completely go away. So if there is still some antibody response, maybe that's okay. So is what I'm hearing that maybe the ELISpot spot is a better way to get a sense for whether the immune system is actively engaged with a particular pathogen, and can be a good indicator to say, yes, treatment of this particular pathogen appears to have been successful?
It's a short-term memory marker. Short marker, you know, the antibodies are long-term markers. You can have antibodies IgG for years, and it doesn't make sense to control IgG because it's still there. Maybe it's negative before you treat, and then you have flux, and it's positive. Then you can say, oh, now I've proven that it's really Lyme disease. You know, that makes sense, but it doesn't make sense to control forever antibodies.
And if my idea is correct, and it may not be correct, but I generally don't think that we fully eradicate Borrelia, Babesia, Bartonella. I think to some level they do persist in the body. Doesn't mean they're continuing to cause a disease state. The same would be true about many of the viruses that you mentioned. Once we have them, we don't necessarily get rid of Epstein-Barr. So if an ELISpot is negative, is it true to say it doesn't necessarily mean that that pathogen isn't present in the body, but it's not something the immune system is actively needing to respond to, or it's not active?
You can say at the moment when you do this ELISpot, when you take the blood that day and the weeks before, there's nothing. But it's no guarantee for the future, for sure.
When you have clients that do repeat testing and show an activation of T cells with the ELISpot and later show the microbe is no longer active, have you been able to collect any data around what treatment interventions practitioners are using that lead to successful treatment outcomes of a specific pathogen?
Yeah, this data, to be honest, is missing. We have some data about easy therapy with rocephane and LTT ELISpot, which was done in Germany, a study. So we know that there's a good effect in the treatment, but that's a point we need studies about.
When we use the ELISpot as an indicator of activity for a particular organism like Borrelia, can we get a sense for whether or not the ELISpot activity after successful treatment generally remains negative, or if there is the potential that at some point in the future the ELISpot becomes positive again? And does this give you any insights from a treatment perspective? Should we continue to be on some long-term herbal antimicrobials, pulse therapy, something along those lines, so that we're not completely taking our eye off of the potential of a pathogen becoming an issue again in the future?
The ELISpot, as I told you, is like you're doing high-sensitive CRP. Just the longer period you reflect. So if a patient get a relapse, I would do the ELISpot again for Borrelia. Then you know, or for the pathogen which was active before. This is, I think, a very important point. You need not to control all ELISpots. You just control the ELISpots which were positive before your treatment. So if you have a problem with Yersinia infection, let me name it that way, or Chlamydia, and not Borrelia, then you just control the Chlamydia ELISpot. And you treat Chlamydia and you don't treat Borrelia.
When an ELISpot has gone negative, is that from a clinical perspective, because I know you've also been a treating physician, is that then an indication that treatment could potentially be completely stopped, or are you still an advocate of longer-term maintenance strategies using herbs and other things?
I would not just make it depend on the ELISpot result. If it's negative, it's a good sign, but I also a lot of CD57 cells and CD3 cells. I check also the natural killer cells, which play important role in the, as a prognostic marker. It was in the former guidelines by Joe Toscano, for example, the islets guidelines. So for me and for a lot of doctors I know, they swear on the CD57 as a prognostic marker, the higher the better. There are studies about it. But on the other hand, also one, it's laboratory testing, you know, and you always need to correlate the lab test findings at the point when you take the blood with the current symptoms. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. And also, to be honest, a question of money again.
Right. Talk to us about Yersinia. I think in the U.S. particularly, it's one of the potential associated microbes that we don't talk about a lot. So what is Yersinia? How do we come in contact with it? How common is it? What are some of the symptoms? And then what potential therapies might be used in someone that has Yersinia?
Yersinia, you eat it up by mayonnaise or ice cream or hamburgers or chicken or eggs. So I ask all the patients, did you eat some chicken in the past? Do you like mayonnaise? Do you like burgers? Whatever. And the travel anamnesis. If you travel to foreign countries, there's dirty water or because it's an enteropathogen, an enterobacteria, it makes some milder diarrhea. Persistent diarrhea or gut issues. But the problem is not the gut. The problem is or are the joints. It makes reactive arthritis. It makes concentration problems, memory for chronic fatigue syndrome, sensitivity problems. So it's similar to Lyme disease, but it's not Lyme disease. You know, you need to differentiate. Or a patient has Lyme disease plus his infection, who knows? And the more you travel around, the higher is your exposure to that. So Yersinia is a bacteria, and it needs also different antibiotics. So it's important to know, is your ELISA spot positive or not for that? If you have these symptoms, milder diarrhea, 10% also get persistence in the gut, and you need to check the stool for Yersinia if they're not infectious for other people.
Is it a fairly common finding on an ELISA spot panel to see Yersinia positive results?
Yes, in fibromyalgia and rheumatoid arthritis, I would postulate that. Also, chronic fatigue syndrome and I would always ask the gut question in the past. Was it fine? Did you have an event somewhere? And then it's the question of the anamnesis we named the questionnaires or the questions.
If someone shows a positive ELISpot result to the new Aspergillus peptide mix that you've incorporated into the panel, could this be an indicator that they may be getting exposure to water damage and mold in their living environment? Or was that test introduced for another purpose?
No, the test is for patients maybe who have immune deficiencies, who have problems with toxins, and who have a very weak immune system. And also don't forget, if you use long-term antibiotics, you suppress your immune system. It's like a chemotherapy, and then you can get candidosis or aspergillosis. But it's also in the household. The test itself cannot differentiate, but we can say by these indications, is Aspergillus active or not? Today, I saw such a result. It was a high ELISpot by 18, which was for me surprising in this patient. And it's also more helpful than doing Aspergillus antibodies.
What are some of the best tools for testing newborns for the potential of these chronic infections? Does someone doing an ELISpot need to be a certain age to have their own immune system rather than having inherited the response from the mother in order to get an adequate result?
It depends on the age of the newborn. Up to 6 months, you have a natural production by Borrelia IgG from the mother. But if a baby would present with 2 months IgM antibodies against Borrelia, that's a proven case of infection, maybe after birth or during birth. So the antibodies make sense to do in newborn, but I would not do the ELISA. I would always do the Western blots because it's higher sensitive. On the other hand, you should also do the ELISpot for a newborn. The ELISpot doesn't differentiate how old is the patient now because it's not normal to have T-cell or immune reactions. You have a threshold, one cell, that's it, 0, 1 cell. And if this would be positive for newborn, then you can say, okay, there's an, same we talked about, the last 6 to 8 weeks, there is an active infection in the body. But there's one problem, Scott, the volume of the sample. We need 4 to 5 milliliter blood, and this is difficult for newborns to get this. So in some cases, I say do PCR in the baby's blood or do the antibodies by Western blood volume.
Okay. This question was sent in from a listener. So if someone has a negative ELISpot spot indicating they do not have active infection, is that potentially a good sign in terms of the minimizing the potential of transmission of these microbes to another person, to an unborn child during pregnancy? Is it a good idea to confirm prior to getting pregnant that someone's ELISpots spots are completely negative? What are your thoughts on that topic?
Yeah, this is also an ethical question. You know, if you do a testing of a pregnant woman, a screening, you find positive ones, what would you say? Don't get, if you want to get pregnant, you would say don't get pregnant. First, you want to eradicate or get some use some antibiotics. On the other hand, a negative ELISpot is always better than to have a positive one. No, because a positive one indicates something. But we discussed before, it can be also a new control infection doing nothing to the unborn or to the newborn. Nothing. Nothing will happen. No? So on the other hand, I think there can be a risk, but we should not overestimate the risk of this. But I would not do a ELISpot as a screening test for pregnant women in general.
Okay. You have said in the past that there is no Lyme patient without an infection in addition to Borrelia, and that that addition is often chronic viruses. So let's talk a little about the viruses. My observation over the years has been that the chronic viruses play a much larger role in chronic health challenges than most patients or practitioners really recognize and explore. What has the viral testing that you've done with Armin Labs led you to in terms of the importance of exploring these viruses when someone has a chronic health challenge? How important are the viruses?
Yeah, the viruses, as I told you, if you have a lot of patients, they don't come forward by antibiotics. And that was my experience too. Then you say, okay, I need long-term antibiotics. But before I would do that step, I would check for other pathogens. We have 5 different pathogens in this group. It's bacteria. Borrelia belongs to bacteria. The co-infections belong to bacteria. We have the viruses. It's a second big group. We have the parasites. It's a third big group. And we have the yeast, fourth, and the mold group. So within this pathogen world, we need to differentiate. And my observation is that if you don't come forward in therapies, you need to think about a new concept. And also you need to check for viruses because you get opportunistic infections. Some have herpes of the lips, if you ask them, or genital herpes. Some have varicella zoster reactivations. And by this model or by this how to come forward with a patient, I would always think about viruses. Other hand, we have viruses, they do the same symptoms you have in Lyme disease. Say, if you have EBV, for example, we can discuss, this could be an example for that.
So of the viruses that you do test with the ELISpot, which ones seem to be the most prevalent?
If I would recapitulate, I think most common in the world is the Epstein-Barr virus, EBV, it's position one. Position two is herpes simplex virus, maybe similar to Epstein-Barr virus in the distribution. And position three is the varicella zoster virus, and the position four is the cytomegalovirus. HHV6, 7, 8 play a role, but a minor role.
So let's then talk about Epstein-Barr virus. So in the US, it's fairly common. People will run a traditional lab panel for Epstein-Barr virus, then maybe be a little unclear about the interpretation and what it means. Maybe say, well, that just means you had it in the past, but we're not actively going to treat it. Is the ELISpot then a better test for determining whether or not the EBV is active and does actually require treatment?
Yes. it makes sense. It came from transplantation medicine, the ELISpot for EBV and CMV also, and herpes. So if you have a kidney transplant, you're immune suppressed and you don't find antibodies, we come again to the model, but you find T cell eliminations. And then we come to the ELISpot again. And this is a test which is accredited. It's done in a lot of universities in the worldwide for this indication. But chronic Lyme, as we mentioned, it's politically discussed if it exists or not exists or whatever. But we know by Lyme immune suppression, then EBV is blowing up and symptoms are same. And so we have a perfect lytic antigen. And if you Google for it, Wikipedia, whatever, the lytic antigen, if this is positive, is absolute indication for replication of Epstein-Barr virus. And I find a lot of these patients.
How much of a role do you feel Epstein-Barr plays in terms of the symptom picture and those people also dealing with Lyme disease? Is it a big player or a smaller player?
This is a good question, Scott. Today we got the paperwork from CDC about IgM in chronic Lyme, that it's not chronic Lyme, that it's 50% unspecific, whatever. But my question to that paper would be, could that be a part of it, maybe Epstein-Barr virus reaction? Because EBV is similar in the protein reactions you have with Lyme disease, Borrelia burgdorferi. So positive IgM in the Western blood doesn't mean that you suffer from isolated IgM, especially that you suffer from a Lyme disease, or that you have Borrelia antibodies, maybe you have EBV antibodies. We name it a polyclonal stimulation of the IgM antibodies, and we have the same effect for the IgG, but for the ELISpot, not. The ELISpot is high specific for that. So also the EBV ELISpot helps you to understand, is it now active Borrelia by positive ELISpot, or is it active Epstein-Barr virus infection by positive EBV ELISpot, and differentiate them.
It's been said that Coxsackie virus is your favorite personal virus and the most important to explore. So tell us why you focus so much on Coxsackie virus. What kinds of issues does it create? And when it is present, how is treatment approached?
Yeah, the Coxsackie is a surprising story now. I think Coxsackie is a little village nearby New York City. And the first cases were described in USA about that. The people had some mild diarrhea, and maybe you know the herb angina, you have some blisters on the lips and they can come back. It looks like herpes similar, but it's not herpes, it's Coxsackie virus. It's the foot mouth disease, and you can get it in kindergarten, in school. So there's a very high transmission, it's high contagious, you can inhale that virus, it's an enterovirus, but this is not the story. The story is a different one. When I started IgA testing for Coxsackie virus, IgA is a really helpful marker in this. I found so many with positive IgAs. What is IgA? IgA is an antibody for local inflammation. We don't have it for Borrelia. We have it for Yersinia, but we don't have it for Ehrlichia. We don't have it for Anaplasma. So this is the next challenge. CDC is working on the testing. We need IgA testing, which is also very sensitive, and it reflects the current activity of an infection. The half-life time is 7 to 10 days. And what is it doing, the Coxsackie virus? Coxsackie virus makes, for example, fatigue. It makes neurological symptoms like multiple sclerosis. It makes also a new study, ALS, amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. It makes dementia. So it makes a lot of psychiatric symptoms. It can do autism. It can do especially arthritis. It can do cardiac heart rhythm problems. It's not Lyme disease, you know. You need to differentiate that. Is it now a virus, or is it a bacteria, or is it both, or is it opportunistic? And this is the job of the doctor in front of you, an infectious disease specialist, to check different infections in your body. Coxsackie is so common, so you cannot believe that.
And when it is present, what types of things would one use to treat it? Is it primarily pharmaceutical antivirals? Is it more herbal strategies?
In this study where I told you, which came in April 2018 with the ALS and dementia patients, they used virostatics. There's, for example, acyclovir, ganciclovir, or some new developments for virostatics, but you need to know that virostatics are virostatics that cannot destroy the virus completely. Mm-hmm. They inhibit the replication cycle of the virus, so they can reduce the viral load, but not eliminate. we know that from HRV discussion. On the other hand, what we know nowadays, it's a lot of TH1, TH2 balances, and that it's immune triggered. So the stronger your immune system is, the better is the outcome of the virus treatment, for sure. You know it from influenza. If, you have sometimes, let's say, the chicken flu or whatever, or swine flu. On the other hand, how to destroy a virus? That's next challenge for us. Where I think we have a chance, it's the herbal antivirals. Some herbs which can or have the ability to destroy a virus. We have some herbs, and I don't know if I could name one book about that. I think it's a good book. We can inform a little about by Stephen Bruner. It's a book. It's not a protocol, what I mean. I mean, it's a book where he describes some herbs, and it's a big book and a huge book, and you can get some information. But I know also that we need to treat the TH1, TH2 disbalance, which is induced by that chronic infection. So we need TH1 support, and there are different protocols. I don't want to mention, not to say have a conflict with mentioning some.
Yeah, and you're welcome to mention anything that you like, but I think the the book you're referring to is called Herbal Antivirals from Stephen Buhner, if I remember correctly, right? Yeah, it's on my yes. Bookshelf here somewhere. Just so you have observed a correlation between people with multiple chemical sensitivities and cytomegalovirus using the ELISpot technology. So I'm interested in hearing a little about that. And then have you similarly been able to correlate any specific pathogens with mast cell activation syndrome, which is becoming a very popular topic in terms of potential microbial triggers for the activation of mast cells and the overproduction of histamine?
Yes, absolutely. Important question. We know that cytomegalovirus is highly associated, CMV, it's named, it belongs to the herpes group. You can do ELISpot, cheap testings, and then you find out, is it active, is it not active? Again, back antibodies, IgG, IgM, are not helpful. You can spare the money. They don't show some. We don't have IgA testing. So if I would have IgA, I would do for CMV, I would do for EBV. We have for varicella, that's helpful, and we have it for herpes simplex, the IgA test. That helps for reactivations. And this is very established. With the MCAS, I can say yes, the mast cells, because I have my own problem with myself, and I'm my own patient, and I know what it means. So yes, absolutely. These viruses, Coxsackie, Echo virus, CMV, play a very important role in MCAS, and they need to be checked in these patients.
Very good. Let's talk a little bit about chlamydia. So in Europe, my observation over the years has been practitioners exploring Borrelia generally do also look for chlamydia pneumoniae. It's fairly uncommon that I see practitioners in the U.S. always also exploring chlamydia. So tell us a little about why exploring chlamydia is so important in someone with suspected Lyme disease.
In the 90s, there was a hype with chlamydia, like it happened with Borrelia. And a hype with atherosclerosis and a lot of illnesses like multiple sclerosis, like rheumatoid arthritis, like chronic fatigue, they all were described in correlation with chlamydia pneumonia. That's fact. On the other hand, 50% of the doctors or the minority, they postulated that to check for chlamydia, and then surprisingly, the way was left. What can happen to Lyme disease also if you're not careful in not respecting chronic infections. So that happened, and afterwards, nobody checked for chlamydia pneumonia or mycoplasma pneumonia. But now it's a little revival at time. You know, Judith McGloshy from Alzheimer's Research Center in Lausanne and former Canada, she told me some years ago that chlamydia pneumonia makes a lot of problems with multiple sclerosis, for example. And this is a pathogen which is similar to Lyme disease, the symptoms, you know, symptomatology. The symptoms are similar. So then I checked these patients that I talked before with Borrelia, Lyme disease, and chlamydia infection, and I found 80% cold. Or with both infections. I think if you treat Lyme and you choose the right antibiotics, you also treat chlamydia, you also treat mycoplasma. But if you choose just rocephin, ceftriaxone, this will not help against chlamydia mycoplasma. And maybe some patients who believe they suffer from Lyme disease are in reality suffering from chlamydia mycoplasma infections. Rocephin is not working, you know, and then they have the problem afterwards suffering from chronic chlamydia and mycoplasma infections.
You have said that in most cases of fibromyalgia, chronic fatigue syndrome, MS, autism, Lyme, that mycoplasma, chlamydia, and viruses are very, very common. So do you see those as core drivers of the condition, or do you see them more as opportunists, meaning that they are really activated because of an underlying immune dysregulation?
No, for me, I worked in infectious diseases in hospital, and for me is the question, what is the dominant infection? What is the secondary infection? What is the infection which doesn't make the main problems? I remember I had a patient with two parasites, came from Africa to my hospital, and she had Strongyloides, Stercoralis infection, and also that time, what was the other one, Ascaris or something like that. So she had two parasites in the same body. The question is, what is the dominator, you know? And by my observation, it's different from patient to patient. So you cannot generalize. You cannot say everybody has Lyme. You cannot say everybody has chlamydia infection. You need to have an individual testing for a patient. And then we know, is it dominant chlamydia? And you see by the ILI spots how high the reactions are. Or is it a weak reaction in the Borrelia ILI spot? Or is it dominant Borrelia infection? So for me, laboratory reports are really like, I read them like a Bible, you know. For me, it's a lot of information, a lot of interpretation behind this. It's not just to checking, oh, this is positive, this is positive. For me, it's a question, what is the dominant infection? And also during treatment, maybe you are successful in treating chlamydia infection. The ILI spot is getting negative, but Borrelia is still active. You know, then you have Borrelia problem, but you have not chlamydia problem. Or you treat on the opposite, you treat a virus. The ILI spot is going down and Borrelia is still active. You know, you need to differentiate this. Every patient is different from the other. You cannot generalize this.
When we do an ELISpot spot panel, can we say that the dominant infection is the one with the highest ELISpot spot result?
By my experience, yes. And if you see that the viruses, they react up to 400 spots in the ELISpot, or 500 we can detect. It's a horrible number. You know, the whole blood is full of T cells we got sent from therapists or patients. So it's really important to do individualization of the report and then to treat the dominant infections. Or the IgA is the same marker. Where is it positive? Where is it not positive? Your aim of therapy is to bring it all down to negative results and to bring CD57 cells high. This is the aim of therapists.
Your lab also offers immune testing like IgM, IgG, and IgA testing for different pathogens. When would one potentially want to do ELISpot testing, and when would we want to do the immune testing? Should we potentially do both of them? How do you give guidance to practitioners about when it makes sense to do one versus the other?
It depends also which test is available on the market. You know, which test has the criteria where I started from, which test is CE certified, which test is not home good, which test is really IBD registered, which you can compare, which is maybe accredited, all of this discussion behind. And we don't have all tests for IgA. We have it for Yersinia, which is helpful. We have it for Chlamydia, which is helpful. And if I would have an IgA test and an ELISpot, I would do both. But if I have just IgM and IgG and ELISpot, I would do just ELISpot. No, so the IgA is for me one of the markers for the future.
Tell us a little more about IgA. I know you've talked about that at some conferences as well as being something that you're very excited about. What is the significance of the IgA testing? And is it true that IgA is more traditionally found kind of in the interfaces to the outside world, so the sinuses, the gut, or is IgA also in the entire body?
Yes, IgA has two parts. One is a systemic part systemically produced in infections like IgM, like IgG. But the advantage is we have a part which is just localized produced. I cannot say where it's produced. It doesn't show up. Yes, you can show up by IgA subclasses. We can also differentiate a little if it's coming from the sinus, we have the opportunity, or it's more from the systemic. So we can differentiate a little, but it's difficult to differentiate to say it's exactly coming from there and there. But on the other hand, it's localized infection. All infections we discussed now, all of these core infections are not systemic infections. Primarily, they are localized infections in the heart, in the brain, in the nerve system, in the joints, in the tendons, wherever, on the lymph nodes, wherever you find them. But in the beginning, they are generalized infections. You find in the beginning IgM antibodies. This is the hospital marker, I name it. Hospitals, if you get a very fresh Bulsarish, you find maybe IgM, then hospitalized, or say, you're not sure, Bell's palsy, whatever, you find IgM, also in spinal fluid, but not later on. Later on, IgA is the marker you find. And IgA has a very short half-lifetime, I mentioned, 7 to 10 days. So you can say if IgA is positive, you do therapies within 3-4 weeks, it can be negative. So you have a good monitor marker.
When somebody does immunoglobulin-based testing and an ELISpot, and they find, let's say that you have one is positive and the other is negative, how do you then kind of correlate those two different pieces of information? What does it mean? Do you treat, do you not treat?
Now we come back to the, I mentioned in a short sentence that we have secondary subclass deficiencies for IgG or IgA, and we have also secondary T-cell level deficiencies. So, and we have combination of it. That's immunology. Some patients develop both, very sick patients, again, HIV model. Some patients develop IgG problems. They cannot produce IgA. So you need to document the level of IgA. Is it normal? And therefore, I say, if you're not sure for that, please do a quantification test in your laboratory nearby for IgG, IgA, IgM. Then you know if you have normal levels for that. Do it in celiac disease markers, for example, too. On the other hand, both systems complement each other. So if you just check one system, you miss the information of the other system. On the other hand, IgA seems to be a very sensitive marker, and the ELISpot. And you have the individualized situation, again, of the immune system. So you cannot generalize all of this.
So it sounds then, if I'm hearing what you're saying correctly, that if you had a positive ELISpot or you had a positive IgA test, either one of those, that potentially is an active issue that might warrant some treatment. If it's just a positive IgM or IgG, it's a little more of a gray area.
Scott, coming back, we don't treat laboratory test results, we mm-hmm. treat symptoms. Yeah. If the symptom correlates with a lab test finding positive IgA and you have some sinusitis, you have some sputum, some biofilms, and you have memory fog, and you have some cough time to time, then you have this chlamydia infection by IgA documentation. And then you treat this specifically, and then you improve, you produce a lot of slime, you need to drink, you need biofilm breakers too against chlamydia mycoplasma, and then you get better by that. So these markers are really helpful in the short term, but please don't treat just the laboratory tests.
Understand, yeah, very good, very good. Let's talk a little about IgM versus IgG. Historically, I think most people think of IgM as more recent or acute, IgG as more memory. We know in Borrelia that's not necessarily the case, that it can hide from the immune system and that there can be a cycling back and forth between IgM and IgG over a period of time. So what does IgG mean from your perspective with these chronic infections? One of the listeners commented that they had seen a fairly high number of elevated IgG titers on the TickPlex panel and wondered how those might be interpreted.
Yeah, TickPlex is a very sensitive test, so we discussed it with test producers, and we do a webinar next days about that. The IgG means, per definition, a former infection without IgM and IgA. Okay, so IgM is very established. IgA we don't have for all pathogens. That's problematic. also in the TickPlex, it's not included. Therefore, you can do the activity testings in this case by ELISpots if it's available. So, if, for example, if you have Bartonella in the TickPlex positive IgG and you have some Bartonella symptoms, you do the ELISpot for it, and then you find it is active or not active. If you don't have an ELISpot, you say again clinical decision. But normally we don't treat IgG antibodies. You know, it means a former infection. And the next point, it can be polyclonal stimulation again. So some of these pathogens is active in your body. You don't know which one. And the IgG, okay, you say now it's a high specific antigen, but you know it can be in some cases polyclonal stimulated, also the IgM. And you cannot be sure. In this case, ELISpot again is helpful. If you don't have it, it's complicated. And then again, we come back to the symptoms and what to treat, differentiate.
What role does the form that the Borrelia is in the body have on the ELISpot results? So I know for a while there was some discussion about your lab doing round body form testing or cyst form testing. Is the ELISpot more likely to identify Borrelia when it's in one form primarily versus another?
By my perspective, we came by European study. I was involved in the Heilisens project, European project for 4 million euro. And we found with Professor Gilbert and some other university professors that the chronic Lyme patients all produced antibodies against round bodies, or maybe cyst forms or L forms, whatever. The best word is pleomorphic forms from the scientific point of view. So in this case, we found a lot of these pleomorphic, and that was the idea behind this TickPlex basic. And what I can tell you by reality, we find a lot of these chronic antibodies not by Western blots, but by the TickPlex basic, which includes the persister forms. Nobody's checking them. Why not to check by test systems or other or new test systems? On the other hand, this shows you that you suffer from persister forms, that your body has or had a contact. And again, then you need the ELISpot to say, is it active or not the process? So it complements also again, and maybe you do CD7 cells, you check how chronic it is. What about the natural killer cell? What about the cytokine storm? And then you have a complete picture. You know, this it's not so easy to understand, but I think the way in the future will really to check all chronic Lyme patients for persister forms.
So persister forms can be the result of specific treatments, right? It's essentially a protected form of these microbes that allows it to eventually kind of reseed the system, so to speak. When someone has persister forms, if you then correlate that to ELISpot results, do you generally find that the immune system is actively engaged with those persisters, or has the immune system essentially kind of pumped the brakes and isn't really paying attention to those until they shift to a different form?
That's also a very good question to answer this, to say we don't have studies about that, but just by my personal, I do thousands of testings each year, I don't know how many now. So what I can see, a general impression is that you have patients with persisters, and they nearly all show active ELISpots in this.
Okay, perfect.
This seems to be really the most sickest patients.
Yeah, that's very helpful. You mentioned earlier that sensitivity of ELISpot is significantly better than testing of immunoglobulins or antibodies. How about specificity? If we have a positive ELISpot, is there the potential for cross-reaction with something else like we used to have with band 31 on a Western blot?
You never can exclude that. Never can exclude any test system in the world, any serological or T cell immune test system. But on the other hand, the specificity, we talk about test specificity and not clinical specificity. Mm-hmm. Again, coming back to the clinical aspects. On the other hand, the antigens are highly purified, so 99.9%. And if you clinical picture to that, it's not unspecific, it's not cross-reactive. On the other hand, we know it's difficult to differentiate now the clinical picture. And we come back again to the ELISpot. I think the ELISpot is more specific than we can postulate from Borrelia IgM antibodies. And check this paper from today.
Let's talk a little more about CD57. So I would say, you know, 10 years or so ago, it used to be fairly commonly done in the US as a kind of marker for progress of treatment. I don't see practitioners doing it quite as much anymore. I think to some extent, it's kind of fallen a little out of favor. Do you generally see that as people are recovering, CD57 is improving? And then what besides Borrelia can lead to reductions in CD57?
I have doctors, they swear on CD57 cells. They don't do ILI spots. They just do CD57 cells, and they say it correlates perfectly with the chronic condition or with my progress or my improvement in treatment. So they do it also for staging, that means for monitoring. What I can say, it's a general inflammation marker, and if it's low, it's for me a sign for bacterial infection. Borrelia and or chlamydia and or mycoplasma and or Yersinia and or streptococcus and or staphylococcus and or coli and or Klebsiella, whatever. It's not a specific marker, but it's really helpful in the additional clinical picture you get from patient. And it's a monitoring marker. So in Europe, we haven't left that way. I have very good experiences with it. And on the other hand, I think it's very important to check in parallel for the CD3 cells. The CD3 plus cells are, we talked before, the opportunistic marker for virus infections. You get the information for the same price and the same testing CD7 cells. You know? So this is so important to know about CD3 plus, CD56, also in virus infections, and CD57. And CD3 can be also elevated in parasites, and CD57 can be also elevated in parasitic infections. So I think it's a helpful general screening marker. It's not a specific marker, but it's a marker which doesn't cost so much, and you can do good monitoring.
So when CD57 is increasing with treatment with the practitioners that you work with, are you generally finding that that happens with antimicrobial therapies, or are they also doing things to support the immune system like medicinal mushrooms, things along those lines?
Yeah, I live myself with reduced CD57 cells without knowing that, without having biggest symptoms in the world in comparison to other patients. But on the other hand, I think the higher the better. You can say two things. If a patient is coming to me and CD57s are low, I say two things. You have pain in your body. It's a chronic pain marker. That's very important. So you have some arthritis, maybe Borrelia infection, I don't know, or chlamydia, and you suffer longer than 1 year. It's absolute, and I swear, all of these patients say yes, 100%.
Is there still value in doing traditional Western blot testing for Lyme disease? Is that something that Armin Labs even offers or not?
No, we do still our Western blots. The Western blot is old-fashioned method. Next generation testing is now the modern Western blot, the Sierra spot testing, which is microarray testing. We do that in most patients, but Western blots we can do, but it's an old-fashioned method. Yersinia Western blots. Maybe it's better to do tickplex testing nowadays. If you have the most modern technology is tickplex basic or tickplex in general. After that, the microarray is coming, but the sensitivity problems again with the microarrays and cutoffs are definition are a problem. But the Western plot is a dying method.
Okay, very good. Talk to us a little bit about the conditions that you might observe associations to specific pathogens based on your testing. So are there some pathogens that when people have ELISpot positive results that they tend to correlate with specific conditions?
Yeah, in fibromyalgia, rheumatoid arthritis, we find a lot of Ehrlichia anaplasma, Rickettsia, Yersinia, Coxsackie, HHV6, Chlamydia mycoplasma. And we can do a panel testing for that if somebody is suffering from it. It's this way. In multiple sclerosis, we find also problems, Chlamydia mycoplasma, Bartonella to mention, Coxsackie, EBV, CMV, HHV6, again, the herpes virus group. In chronic fatigue, which is a very common problem in the world, we have Borrelia problems for sure, Chlamydia, Mycoplasma, Bartonella, Parvovirus to mention, Parvovirus B19, Coxsackie virus, Echovirus, EBV, CMV, herpes simplex 1, 2, HHV6. You see, this is a bundle of testings, but we know that in every patient it's different. You know, you cannot generalize every patient with CFS as all of this. infections active. In Alzheimer's and dementia, I want to mention a new study with Coxsackie and Echovirus, a cheap testing for it. Also, Borrelia can do that, Chlamydia, Mycoplasma, Herpes Simplex, 1,2-EBV. So you see, you come always to the same pathogens. If you summarize, in Parkinson's, you can explore Borrelia, Chlamydia, Mycoplasma, Bartonella, Coxsackie, Echo, EBV, CMV. Autism, we know that it can be Borrelia infection, Chlamydia, Mycoplasma, Coxsackie, EBV, CMV. So you see, we can do some panel testings, which is possible. If patients and doctors are not so sure what they want to do, panel testing makes sense.
How often does someone that has a diagnosed autoimmune or neurological condition such as MS, how often might we find positive ELISpot results if they were to do some testing? And then extending on that, is autoimmunity essentially triggered by these chronic infections, or does the body attack itself for no real reason or in absence of a specific trigger?
Yes, in MS, as I told you before, Lyme disease can be the reason, but you have always multiple infections, especially. It's not just MS. I think more common is chlamydia, what we see, and the herpes virus in MS. But on the other hand, Borrelia is triggering it. Maybe Borrelia is a starter for the whole story. A tick bite starts with it. The menu is coming later with this opportunistic infections. But MS, to say every patient has no Lyme disease, that's not correct. The autoimmune disorder is very interesting. In the ELISpot, we have the LFL1 antigen because Borrelia can do, it's named the mimicry effect, it can do autoimmune disorders. And we check all of these patients in our ELISpots, one of the three antigens we are testing. And if you or the patient has this positive LFL1, then we need to know about autoimmune markers like ANA, CCP antibodies, and the vasculitis marker ANCA. So because we know there's, but don't forget that EBV can also do autoimmune disorders. Coxsackie can do juvenile diabetes, for example. So the autoimmune disorders complexity is also a virus complexity and combination with some bacteria. And it depends on the patient what is, or which pathogen is triggering what, but the LFL1 is really helpful in the Borrelia.
So am I hearing you correctly that when there is an autoimmune condition, there is a high suspicion that microbes are playing a role in the autoimmune response?
Yeah, in every case. You need to fill out checklist. I developed a co-infection checklist on the website. It's free of any cost. You can fill out. It costs nothing. And then you see if you belong to the group of the viruses and the other pathogens and Lyme disease or not. That makes sense, because otherwise, if it's the reason why you trigger your autoimmune, your Hashimoto's, for example, or your juvenile diabetes with the Coxsackie, you need to treat it early. You know, otherwise, it's an on-standing autoimmune reaction.
Yeah, and then on the topic of the checklist, that was something I was going to mention as well. It is on the website. You can put in symptoms and it will kind of tally the likelihood of certain co-infections or certain microbes being present that then might guide you to specific tests that you might do. Is that pretty well matched up for U.S. people as well, or is it more targeted for specific geographies?
No, this was developed by myself from teaching books. You find it in infectious diseases books, which symptom belong to which don't name it co-infection. It's so nice. Name it which infection has which symptoms. Not every infection is doing every symptom. So this was developed by that, and it's international.
Let's talk a little bit about rickettsia. That's another organism or category or family of organisms that I think is not commonly talked about much in kind of the realm of Lyme disease. You've mentioned in some of your prior work that in Switzerland, 25% of ticks were free of pathogens, 32% had Borrelia, but 42% had rickettsia. So in that study, more rickettsia than Borrelia. So do you see lots of positive ELISpot results when you're testing for rickettsias?
We don't have ELISpots, Scott, for rickettsia, but I can do a good message. It will come in a few weeks. This study was done on the ticks, and we found that in the ticks in the first time, you know. So the tick PCR is very good. It's on the species level, and in Switzerland, it's Rickettsia helvetica, and 50% are contaminated. pets here. But this is not the normal tick. It's a, you name it, a Demacentor tick. It looks a little black tick. It's a dog tick. This is different tick species. So different tick species carry different pathogens in them, and they have also Babesia in them. So it's not so much Borrelia in this. It depends on the tick, on the endemic hotspot you have with the ticks. And But we have Rickettsia antibodies. I'm not so satisfied with it. But Rickettsia, you can do by the tick plex now. It's more sensitive.
And are you anticipating that you'll see fairly high rickettsial ELISpot spot results?
I'm sure, like the Bartonella ELISpot and Babesia, yeah. We find more than antibodies for sure.
Okay, beautiful. So let's talk about how people can get some of the testing that you make available. Is there a particular panel that can explore the common microbes that we've been talking about in someone who has Lyme disease? I know there's the TickPlex panel. Is that still what you offer? What do you recommend in terms of panels through Armin Labs?
TickPlex is a screening test which you can do for a good price, I would say. It's a multiple panel with a lot of antigens, IgG, IgM. If you want to do screening for yourself, it makes sense, but it doesn't tell you about the active processes. So coming back, you need ELISpots. If you're positive for IgG, you don't know is it an active infection or not. You can do a step-by-step diagnostics. I do a TickPlex combination of all of the pathogens, then I know where I had or have contact. That's always the question. On the other hand, for me, it's maybe better to fill out the co-infection checklist on my website and then to decide individual panels. Now that makes more sense to find it better, because screening is screening, individual testing is individual testing, and I would always prefer the individual way if it's possible. But if you say, okay, I want to screen, the only test I would say to do in general would be the TickPlex Basic, because there we have the dark body antibodies. Nobody has this, and to find out about Lyme disease if you have the sister forms or not.
Is there a panel for the ELISpot, or are those ordered individually based on each microbe that you want to test?
We have panels which are designed by the symptoms, by the illness. We have multiple sclerosis panel, we have autism panels, we have a fibromyalgia panel, chronic fatigue panel, dementia panel. So we developed a lot of panel testings. You can do that if you want that.
How do patients in the U.S. access your tests? How do they get the blood drawn? Can they traditionally go to a local lab? I know a lot of times it's difficult to get the local labs to draw test kits these days. Do they need a doctor to order the test kit? Do they need a doctor to sign the requisition? Can they work with you directly? How do we get access to these?
I don't have any cooperation with laboratories like LabCorp or Quest, or there's no cooperation. I don't have any correlation with university labs. Patients can send themselves going to the doctor, or the doctor can order, take the blood. A nurse practitioner can take the blood. You need somebody. Or you fly to Romania, to Transylvania, and Dracula is taking your blood. You need somebody taking your blood. That's the easiest way. Or you stick the needle by yourself. So most patients and nearly all patients send themselves or some therapists behind them. But, you know, it's not so easy in this field for therapists.
And does the testing require a doctor to sign the requisition, or if patients can
no,
get...
It's the will of the patient and or the people. The people want to know what is, if this is not over, they want to know what is active in that blood or not.
And is Armin Labs covered by any insurance companies, or is it all private pay?
In Germany, yes. Nearly all private health insurances pay this. In all other countries, nothing.
So in the U.S., we would assume not covered by insurance. People can order it. They don't need a doctor. They just need someone to draw the blood. And then
also
can.
Australia, also other European countries. It's not so accepted, you know, by the health systems. In Germany, it's a more open-minded system. So I have private insurance, and my insurance always pays this.
as we start wrapping up, you've done a lot of treating of these conditions over the years as well. I know you've traveled the world, you've worked with people with Lyme disease in many different countries. How is Lyme disease or chronic Borrelia-associated illness different in different countries? Are there some places where the condition is more aggressive? Is it fairly similar? Are there certain patients where certain places where patients find it more difficult to treat than others?
It's also a good question. We don't know about the aggressiveness or the virulence. We don't have virulence factors like we have in influenza infections because nobody's caring less for that point in science. But we know that Borrelia can be really aggressive. It can damage your brain. It can eat up your brain, can damage it, and you can die by that, by myocarditis. We had in Germany 8 death cases in 2014 documented by Lyme carditis. Now they stopped the documentation. You know, we have now the new ICD codes in the future, ICD-11 codes, and we hope that there will be a lot of more registration of sick people with these conditions with Lyme carditis. But it's a big discussion in the world if it exists, and I think the worst thing happens with the definition of post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, which was done, which has for me no explanation. This is nonsense explanation. It's nothing. There's no proof for it.
So that was actually my next question. So sure. If we talk about post-Lyme syndrome or post-Lyme disease treatment syndrome, what are your thoughts on that? Does it really mean that the chronic infections are no longer playing a role?
Yeah, the test will tell you the story. If the IgA is positive or the ELISpot is positive, we don't have IgA, but we have ELISpot, if it's positive, I think we should discuss that. As I have cured this multiple sclerosis patient 13 years ago, you know, so we need to discuss that. And it's in some guidelines. We have the German Borrelia Society, and we have taken the LCT into the guidelines, you know, because we have paperwork about that. We have ELISpot arguments. We have pros and cons in this world. It's not decided yet, you know, but you cannot stop a development. As I've started with tuberculosis, now it's the gold standard, the ELISpot or the interferon gamma or the MELISA for it or the QuantiFERON test. And now it's the gold standard. You know, this was development over years. In medicine, it needs 10, 20 years to change something. But there's a really dynamic process. And don't forget, we have like a pea in the onion model. We have not just Lyme disease. We need also to check for pesticides, or geostress, EMF, environmental issues, metals, dental, genetics, epigenetics. It's not everything is infections, but you would see that all of these disciplines, in this peeling the onion model in the core, are always the intracellular infections. All of these infections are intracellular, and we control a lot of them. But if you have some pesticidal problem or geostress, whatever, or toxin problem, our immune system is also destroyed, and then they blow up, and then you have the next challenge, you know. But we need to differentiate. And this leads to individual onion, peeling the onion model for every individual patient. You cannot generalize this. You need expert for peeling the onion.
I think one of the challenges with post-Lyme syndrome is that it somewhat says to a person with Lyme that microbes or Lyme is not really continuing to play a role in your symptoms. We don't really know what's wrong with you, but it's no longer infectious. And it sounds like from the type of advanced testing that you do with the ELISpot with IgA, that in those people that might have been told they have post-Lyme syndrome, that oftentimes there is still an indication that there are active microbial processes in play. Is that a reasonable statement?
I cannot accept the expression post-Lyme syndrome. It's a syndrome. It's just a description of something. It's no reason. I always want to know the reason behind it.
And the reason can still be persistence of infection.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. Okay, you need beautiful. To check this.
Yeah.
You cannot say you have a post-cancer syndrome and you suffer from metastasis from a colon cancer. That would be nonsense. You know, tell a cancer patient, never, no oncologist would do that way. You know, this is not serious medicine at this stage. I cannot accept it from my perspective. So.
I 100% agree with you. In your opinion, with these microbes, Borrelia, Bartonella, Babesia, and so on, do you think that the goal is to fully eradicate them, or do you think that we minimize the burden enough in the system that then the immune system can do its job with some competence and that we don't actually need to eradicate them in order to regain health and wellness?
Some patients need to arrange with the microbes. They will live forever with the microbes. Mm-hmm. They will not, they cannot cure, they cannot eradicate. If you take antibiotics, you should be careful with the risk-benefit ratio. Do you have a risk or do you have a benefit? We don't know what are the risks if you take 10 years antibiotics. Nobody knows now. You know, the evidence will come if you develop a cancer or some immune deficiencies or a virus problem. I think we need to be careful to use chemical weapons, you know. I think a lot of these conditions, whatever we do in our life, is the immune system. Absolutely. But if you have a bad genetics, if you have bad epigenetics, then we have a problem. We cannot change our genetics and epigenetics. So this testing is coming more and more to know about it. But what to do in these patients, you cannot treat with Lyme disease with that. You have a bad genetics. We have some markers, HLA-DR4 is one of them. But the question is, does it make sense to use long-term antibiotics, or maybe better to improve the immune system, the lifestyle, the nutrition? When I went to New York last weekend, it was horrible nutrition, the pollution, the air pollution, the plastics, the microplastics, the toxins, the electrosmog. It's not healthy, you know, and I would get sick myself. So the peeling the onion plays a very important role, but the infection is very bad, active in the illness spot. You need a treatment. You need to try to eradicate. If you can do that, the word cure is, who can guarantee a 100% cure in our life?
Very good. If you were to group viruses, parasites, bacteria, and fungi, is any one of those groups more health impacting than the other?
For me, now viruses are number one in the world. I don't know about the parasites. The parasitical testing is not so good in the world. Mm-hmm. We need better parasites. We all discuss about Lyme disease, but testing is not good. But what about parasites? You know, we have a lot of patients with Toxocaracanes or Ascaris zoom from the dogs and from the pigs. We have it in Austria, and they don't have Lyme disease, but they have similar same symptoms. Or maybe they have additional Lyme disease. So I think we need to work on better testings for parasites. We need to work on better testings for yeast and mold. We have good testings for Lyme and co-infections. We have it. Everybody says, oh, it's so bad. But we all forgot about this discussion with parasites, you know. We should care for it, at yeast and mold problems. It's not everything Lyme. The viruses, we have good testings.
What's the best way for people interested in learning more about you and your work? How can they get more information?
We do some webinars or podcasts like We Did Together. We have a lot of conferences in the world. Not for all patients are allowed to go there. Some are just for doctors. We do, because our aiming group are not the patients, to say that. We need to educate the doctors and to bring this knowledge about what I'm doing in a full-time job. I do all day and night the same, you know. But the doctors, they do it. Not all doctors know about what we know. You know? So we need to bring the knowledge to students at universities, and then we need a special qualification for the peeling the onion model. And if we have that, that would be fantastic. Or we do interdisciplinary teamwork of doctors to educate this center of excellences, but not just for Lyme disease. And maybe we need a center for rickettsia infections in Switzerland. You know, this is, I think, a challenge for the future. And but what we need is a whole body medicine, better education of students, medical students, to learn about symptomatology. If they learn it's post-Lyme disease syndrome or post-Lyme syndrome, they will not care for chronic Lyme, what the patient is telling you. They will send them to psychiatric specialists, and then they get tranquilizers or painkillers or whatever, and that's it, you know. So we need a better whole-body perspective of the next generation of students.
My last question is the same for all of my guests. What are some of the key things that you do on a daily basis in support of your own health?
I don't like antibiotics, but myself. Myself, I have a virus infection, so I treat me. It's not allowed for me to use antibiotics. I work a lot with my nutrition. I lost 30 kilograms. You know me from former times, so
yeah.
And I feel much better. I am more energetic. I have a lot of stress. I tell about myself, but maybe I'm a practical example how you can do a little change in nutrition, change in lifestyle, no stress in practice, relax. Use herbs, use transfer factors, use other complementary ideas, use high-dose vitamins, use maybe curcumin infusions, use hyperthermia, use just some examples. I'm no expert in this, but what I went to stem cells clinic now, and it's big discussions. It's helpful. It's for sure that they help some patients. Otherwise, they would not exist. We did apheresis in Germany. We do now hypothermia with high concentration of antibiotics, which is not helpful in virus infections. So every patient needs a different option, and we need broad-ranged therapies for this patient. And I think the integrative healthcare symposium, which you are doing in Seattle next week, this would be really a highlight. In New York City, it was also not bad. This workshop of functional medicine is coming more and more, like the anti-aging. Anti-aging is now a big thing with the skin, you know, and how you can be younger. But they don't check the infections. Also, we need better lifestyle. I think we live in such a stressed world, and our outdoor behavior is not so good. We don't protect against the ticks. There's no information by the governments. We need prevention. We need tick testing. We need to check what is in the mosquitoes, what is in the horseflies. We need the governments behind that. It's for sure that in the future, the chronic infections, the chronic tropical infections play a main role everywhere around the world. Climate change.
Very good. I woke up this morning excited about talking to you. You certainly did not disappoint. Lots of great information that you've shared here. I appreciate all the work that you're doing. You gave my brain a good workout for the morning here. So thank you, Dr. Schwarzbach, for all of the things that you're doing to provide new tools and new tests and new resources for people dealing with chronic illness. I appreciate everything that you're doing, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
Thank you so much, Scott. You also, I feared a little your questions because you're hyper intelligent in this and really experienced expert. We need to clone you somehow and to bring your knowledge into some doctors' brains and acceptance what the patient's telling. It's also a point. So thank you so much what you're doing for the community.
Thank you very much. To learn more about today's guest, visit arminlabs.com. That's Armin, A-R-M-I-N, labs.com, arminlabs.com. Thanks for your interest in today's show. If you'd like to follow me on Facebook or Twitter, you can find me there as Better Health Guy. To support the show, please visit betterhealthguy.com/donate. If you'd like to be added to my newsletter, visit betterhealthguy.com/newsletters. And this and other shows can be found on YouTube, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify.
Thanks for listening to this Better Health Guy blogcast with Scott, your Better Health Guy. To check out additional shows and learn more about Scott's personal journey to better health, please visit betterhealthguy.com.